The following is testimony by James Hansen from NASA. He's the chief scientist at the Goddard Institute there, and by Tim Helwig Larsen from the Public Interest Research Center in the UK. That's a charity group. They are speaking to the Environmental Audit Committee of the UK government, and the date was November the 26th, 2008. That was on a Wednesday. I recorded this from parliamentlive.tv. You'll find it's full of horrific facts, some solutions, maybe it's not too late, the very things with the updated science that we need to hear about. It's 68 minutes long. Dig in and learn.
For the fact you've taken the trouble to come in and talk to us this afternoon, we're all under a fairly tight time deadline, so I won't spend a lot of time with introductions, simply to say that as far as this committee is concerned, we've focused particularly on climate change and climate change-related issues since the last election 3.5 years ago. So there's been a lot of interest, and I hope a reasonable amount of expertise amongst the members of the committee. And obviously we've followed your work and comments with very great interest. I want to apologise in advance for that, as this was a special meeting, I have another commitment. I have to leave at about 3:10, but Joan Whalley, who is the senior Labour member of the committee, will take over the chairmanship at that time. Perhaps I could ask a general question to begin with. If you'd tell us what you think the most significant developments in climate change science have been since the last IPCC report.
Yeah, there have been a number of things that have made clear that the problem is actually more urgent than we thought just a few years ago. The evidence comes particularly from improved understanding of paleoclimate, the history of the Earth, and how the Earth's climate responded in the past to changes in the boundary conditions, including the atmospheric composition, but also observations of what is happening now. In response to the changes that humans have made in the last century and the global observations that we have of what is happening. The most disturbing conclusion is the fact that the dangerous level of atmospheric greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide in particular is lower than what we thought it was. And carbon dioxide really has to be the focus, because what has not always been well understood is that a large fraction of the CO2 that we put in the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels will stay there a very long time. This is not 50 or 100 years, but more than 1,000 years. So it is the ultimate gas that we must be concerned about. And what has become clear is that even the level that we're currently at, 385 parts per million, is already getting us into the dangerous range. Now, for example, from the paleoclimate, we now have had the opportunity to look and gain some understanding of the climate change on much longer timescales, not just the glacial to interglacial fluctuations, which have been the focus of paleoclimate research in the last couple of decades, but looking at the longer timescales over millions of years, which goes back to times when carbon dioxide was as much as 1,000 parts per million. Well, when that was true, there was no ice on the planet. The sea level was 75 meters higher. The Earth has slowly, CO2 has slowly declined over the last 50 million years. And the interesting thing is that by when it reached a value of about 450 plus or minus 100 parts per million, that's when ice began to form on Antarctica. And then it continued to cool further and we got to this glacial to interglacial. But one thing that tells us is we cannot burn all the fossil fuels and put the CO2 in the atmosphere. That would put us back to 800 parts per million or something, well above the 450 level, and we would be initiating the processes to send us back to an ice-free planet. So we simply can't do that. And that has really direct practical implications, because if you look at how much carbon we have in oil, gas, and coal, and if you realize that the oil has already been used probably about half of it. If we're near peak oil, which is what a lot of experts think, then we've already used about half of the readily mineable oil. And you can't practically capture that because it's used in vehicles and comes out of tailpipes. There's no way to capture it. So if you look at how much carbon there is in oil, gas, and coal and realize we can't capture the oil, what it tells us is we can't burn all that coal. Or if we do use it, we've got to capture the CO2.
Perhaps I can add something at this point. Your question is, what is some of the most concerning recent evidence? And obviously we've had the IPCC's fourth assessment report last year in 2007. What have we seen since then? And the question, I think, might also be asked, what have we seen since the deadline for submissions into the IPCC process, which was a year or more in advance of that? And I think one of the pieces of work which Dr. Hansen has been exploring, which is of particular concern to us, is the situation in the Arctic, that really we are facing a very dramatic change in the sea ice, the ice that floats on the ocean at the top of the Arctic. It's melting away much faster than we thought. And there is really three things coming out of this. We're seeing extra heating, extra greenhouse gas release, and extra sea level rise. And the reason that this comes about is that the first element of it is quite intuitive. If you think of the very vast area of white reflective material at the top of our planet, during the Arctic summer, when it's pointed more towards the sun, that is providing a huge parasol effect to the Earth. And as that melts away, and it has been dramatically, we see that last year the extent of the Arctic was reduced by some 40%, I believe, and the actual volume of the sea ice, which is perhaps the more crucial measure, had dropped by to just 30%. So it had dropped by a full 70% since the year 1979. Now, with the Arctic melting away at that rate, it causes a regional warming, and that regional warming extends inland into Siberia and Alaska. It extends inland some 1,500 kilometres. Now that brings us to, if you like, the second melt, because this is really the story of a triple melt, that the melting Arctic sea ice leads to increased temperatures on land, and we know that there are absolutely vast stocks of carbon locked up in the permafrost in Siberia and in the Arctic Circle. So these huge areas, these huge amounts of carbon are many times larger than our oil and gas reserves, and they are more than twice the size of the carbon that sits in our atmosphere today. And it would only require a small amount of this to completely undermine all of our efforts at decarbonising energy or transport or emissions from industrial exercises. So that would be the second component of our triple melt, and it leads to increased or extra greenhouse gas emissions over and above those that we were expecting. But the third is that, again, consequent of the melting Arctic sea ice, we will see that 1,500 kilometres of warming going inland will extend over the Greenland ice shelf, the Greenland ice sheet. And we are already seeing a change in dynamic processes of ice melt there, things where the patterns that we haven't yet fully understood, but we can see that the ice is melting much faster than expected. So we've got extra warming, we've got extra greenhouse gas emissions release, and we've got extra sea level rise, all on top of them, all extra and over and above the models that are used in the IPCC's advice to policymakers.
Yeah, so, and the thing is, this melt that he talks about is one of the criteria which helps us estimate what is the dangerous level of atmospheric carbon dioxide. If we wanted to stop further melt of the Arctic ice, we would have to restore the planet's energy balance. Now there's more energy coming in than going out because of the trapping of heat by carbon dioxide. We would have to reduce the CO2 amount less than its present amount to no more than 350 parts per million. But it's not only this melt problem that Tim mentions, but there are other things, one of which is also melt, and that's the mountain glaciers all around the world, which are receding at rapid rates and which provide fresh water during the summer and fall for hundreds of millions of people via the rivers that originate in the Himalayas and the Rockies and the Andes and other mountain ranges. And we're going to lose all of those mountain glaciers within 50 years if we stay on business as usual. What we would need to do, again, is actually reduce the CO2 to less than the 385 and to less than 350 parts per million. There are other things that we see happening now which tell us that already we're getting into the dangerous zone. The expansion of the subtropics, which is affecting the climate in regions such as the southern United States and the Mediterranean region and Australia and parts of Africa, making those regions drier and hotter and increasing forest fires in the western and southern United States and in the Mediterranean region. We already see that expansion has occurred. And there's also evidence of increased stress on coral reefs, which are very important for harboring about one-third of the biological species in the ocean. And they're being stressed by both the acidification of the ocean, which again is a direct effect of CO2. As more CO2 is taken up by the ocean, it becomes more acid, and that affects the life that depends upon has carbonate shells or carbonate skeletons. And also the increasing ocean temperature is stressing the coral reefs. So again, it tells us we've actually gone somewhat too far at 385 parts per million. And the only way it is actually possible to draw down the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, both as the ocean takes up more of the CO2, and also if we improve our agricultural and forestry practices, we can draw down CO2 by 50 parts per million or so, restoring some of the forests. But we cannot take it down several hundred ppm. So if we burn all the fossil fuels, there's no practical way to get back to 350.
Okay, I mean, what you've both said have raised a lot of other questions straight away. Just for the sake of clarity, we're going to use the figures. We'll refer to CO2 concentrations rather than CO2 equivalent. Sometimes there's confusion.
I think that's a good idea.
Just in the light of what you've been saying, are you concerned that there's a tremendous focus on reducing annual emissions, and we talk about cutting emissions by so much, 2020, 2050 on. Do you think we should be focusing more on the actual concentration in the atmosphere?
Well, I think you should be focusing on the sources, because and not targets for percent reduction of emissions, but because the lifetime of the CO2 in the atmosphere, a large fraction, is more than 1,000 years. So burning it a little bit slower doesn't make much difference. We actually have to look at how much carbon we have in the carbon reservoirs of oil, gas, and coal. And that really tells us that we cannot burn all of the coal. That's the critical thing, and that's the point that I'm trying to stress to people, that we can't say we have some targets in 2050 or 2030 or any time and still build more coal-fired power plants, because if you do that, there's no way that you're going to prevent getting far into the dangerous zone. You're going to have to stop the coal emissions. That, to me, is by far the dominant issue.
I think this is really at the heart of the question. There was some work done recently at MIT where they questioned 200 of their students on the difference between emissions and concentrations of carbon. And there was huge confusion amongst a large proportion of the respondents, and this is from a technical university, so we need to be absolutely clear about it. I think in this evidence session, I will be referring to CO2 equivalent levels, but we can give you, after the session, those numbers in
sure.
CO2 only. And I think a lot of it, if I just sort of park on the table, we've got obviously the flow of emissions that we are producing here in Britain, that we're producing globally, that fall into the atmospheric pot of carbon concentrations, and the consequence, as we know, of that increasing concentration is elevated temperatures on the planet. And I think your question comes to these first two, which is how do we manage and navigate our way through with these two issues? And we're obviously talking a lot, we hear a lot of discussion about long-term targets for emissions cuts, the cuts in what we're flowing into the atmosphere, but it's of no consequence unless we're conscious of the total budget that that's going into. And as Jim rightly says, if we don't have, if we can't lower concentrations below, reduce the level of the pot below what it is today, we have no confidence that we will have an Arctic left in the future to help maintain the stability of our temperatures and of our planet. So, I mean, it probably comes to, I imagine that later on you'll want to question about the forthcoming Committee on Climate Change's numbers, but that obviously plays into these two elements, into all of these elements of the emissions flow, the stock of emissions or the concentrations, and the consequent temperatures.
Colin.
Yeah, I apologise for having to leave at precisely 3 minutes to three to chair a meeting. From what we've heard already, it sounds to me like we are very close to a tipping point, except we're on the wrong side of that tipping point. Would you agree with that assessment? And what precisely would the phrase tipping point mean? Does it mean a point of no return?
I think there's more than one tipping point. We have probably reached the tipping point for Arctic sea ice. Because the planet is out of energy balance, we're probably going to lose the summer sea ice in the Arctic over the next few decades. But that's a reversible tipping point. If you restore the planet's energy balance or make it slightly negative, then the ice will grow back. But the tipping points that we should be most concerned about, in my opinion, are those which are irreversible on any time scale that we can imagine. And that would include disintegration of the large ice sheets, say on West Antarctica or Greenland. If we reach a point where they begin to disintegrate and the dynamics of the process takes over, and that's really what you mean by a tipping point, where the dynamics of the process begins to take over and the positive amplifying feedbacks just drive you to a large change. If the ice sheet begins to disintegrate and goes, and the process gets too far, then reducing CO2 is not going to stop it. It'll just continue. I don't think, and tipping points are inherently very hard to quantify when you reach the point of no return, because it's a very nonlinear problem. It's like the economic situation. You can have very bad economic policies, and the economy carries on, not much happens, and then finally you get to a point where the thing collapses. But it's very hard to predict what date that's going to happen. But you can predict if you continue negative budget and things, you will eventually get a problem. So the ice sheets, I would argue, we have not reached a tipping point on the ice sheets, because they're still, though they're losing mass at a rate of a couple hundred cubic kilometers per year, that's still fairly small in terms of the total size of the ice sheet, and it's only measured in millimeters of sea level per year. So I don't think we've reached that tipping point. The other one that's irreversible is extermination of species. We're putting pressure on animal and plant species because of the rate of the climate change, which is very unusual. A given temperature line is now moving poleward on average at a rate of about 60 kilometers per decade. And for some period of time, the stress that species will try to migrate to stay within the climate zone that they're comfortable in. But once that total distance becomes too large, some species do not migrate easily, and species are interdependent, so that you can eventually get ecosystem collapse. I mean, now we're beginning to put pressure on some species, like polar bear, for example. But you don't want to get to the point where ecosystems begin to collapse. And that, again, is hard to say, but we're clearly beginning to put stress on species, and there are more extinctions now than is natural.
If I could answer your question, Colin, what are the tipping points and are we passing them? Well, I think we can see from the changes that we're experiencing in our climate right now, today, it's incumbent on us to reduce emissions as fast as possible. Yes, we need long-term targets, but we need to be taking action today. And I think in terms of passing a point of no return, whether or where it exists, I think it comes back to the chairman's point about our understanding of the flow of emissions and the stock of emissions. And some work out just this month from Kevin Anderson and Alice Bowes at the Tyndall Centre has explored this in fantastic detail. Just taking some very simple steps to understanding what our situation is today. What they have done is they've taken the IPCC's own figure of a stabilisation of 450 parts million CO2e, and they have taken that and looked at the carbon budget that would deliver that stabilisation level. So how much carbon is associated with that? They then explore what are the elements that are actually now beyond our control, that we need to actually remove from this budget before we can see how much we've got left to play with. And the first of those is that this is a budget for emissions over 100 years, starting in the year 2000. And because we're already in 2008, we've already spent the first 7 years of that, and so they discount that. They then also go on to look at, they remove an element, in fact, 27% of the budget, which is associated with carbon cycle feedbacks. And this is a recommendation of the IPC itself, that budget should be reduced by 27% to take account of the carbon cycle feedbacks, so another loss. Then on top of that, we've got emissions that we know are going to come from deforestation. Alice and Bowes have both looked at some rather optimistic scenarios for reducing deforestation, but even with those scenarios, there is still some emissions. And then the final element that they remove are the non-greenhouse gas emissions. So they pull out for themselves, if you like, their disposable budget, their disposable income, or the amount that's left to play with for energy and process emissions. So that would include transportation, heating, electricity, and manufacturing industry. And they look at how much energy, how much carbon is there, and crucially, what is the rate of our decline, of our race out of carbon. And what they find through exploring a number of scenarios is that more than half of their scenarios show a decline rate, a descent out of carbon, that they considered to be politically impossible. Now, whether that proves to be the case or not is yet to be seen, but they defined that as an emissions reduction rate of 8% per year over an extended period or more. And the context for this really is that Nicholas Stern has pointed to the fact that there are no situations where any country has moved out of carbon faster than 1% a year for an extended period in a managed way. It's happened in unmanaged ways, and the key example there would be the collapse of the USSR, which saw 5% a year reductions for a continuous period. And if we were trying to look for managed processes, managed examples, we would probably look to the 40-fold increase in nuclear power plants in France over a 25-year period, or perhaps the dash for gas in Britain in the 90s. Both of which only delivered a 1% per year cut in carbon emissions. And what we're talking about is 4, 5, 6, 7, 8% a year. And what this crucially means is that we have to bring forward the start of this race out of carbon. Every year that we delay means that the descent out of carbon will finally be steeper. And so it's absolutely incumbent on us to start that exit now. And so what we've been recommending in our climate safety report that we've just produced is that as well as having long-term targets, as well as cutting out the practices that we just know to be harmful straight off, such as deciding to have no new coal-fired power stations, deciding not to open up any new coal mines, as well as doing those long-term things and those mid-term things, we only have a chance of reaching future stabilisation levels of 450, 350 or below if we take action today and start moving on to the road of decarbonisation. We should probably be looking to augment these long-term policies with something like a 10% reduction by 2010. which can actually step us onto that path, stop our trajectory from rising, and start it declining.
If I may, if you would allow me, I'd like to say one more word about, because I think your question about tipping points really gets to the heart of the matter, and also addresses in a perhaps simpler way that discussion. We see the beginnings of methane hydrates beginning to bubble out. It's another indication, another warning that we're already moving into the dangerous level, and another argument for why we really need to go back to no more than 350. And that's very, it looks like that's incredibly difficult. People would say, oh, as Tim said, well, that's almost impossibly difficult. However, it's not impossible. If you look simply at these reservoirs of carbon and you decide that we're going to either use coal at power plants where we capture it or leave it in the ground, it becomes a doable problem. And then you don't have to argue in terms of the rates. It does imply very strong actions because you're going to have to phase out the coal emissions, and then that tells you how strong your actions have to be. You've got to find renewable energies or energy efficiency to satisfy what you otherwise would have used coal for. And I think that's a doable thing. I think that there's a potential in efficiency and renewables to do that. And maybe you need fourth generation nuclear power, but it's possible to do it. So, and it's better to do it that way than to try to think in terms of percentages, because if you just have goals for what will happen in 2050 and you continue to build coal-fired power plants, then you're guaranteeing that you will not reach that target.
I'm not sure whether the global economic crisis is a result of management or mismanagement, but it may make a contribution in the very short term to at least reversing the rapid growth in concentrations. What you're both saying is extremely interesting. Can I, however, ask for as concise answers as possible? There are quite a lot of questions that I and my colleagues wish to ask. We're just about to undertake an inquiry into forestry starting after Christmas. In the light of what you've just been saying about the contribution that forest restoration can make, what are the sort of targets you think are necessary for that to make a contribution in time? And the government here has published a target for halving deforestation by 2020 and I think getting it neutral by 2030. But are those anything like ambitious enough to make the sort of contribution which is needed?
Well, it would require restoring a large fraction of what has been put into the atmosphere. So it is an ambitious target. I don't claim to be an expert on the forestry aspect of this, but it would require aggressive use of marginal lands, which were forested at one time and now are not very useful for agricultural purposes. You need to allow those to be reforested. And, of course, you have to avoid actions that encourage additional deforestation of lands that are presently forested.
I'll only say a couple of words on this. I think in terms of sustaining our existing stock of forests, it's like Jim says with coal. There's certain things we just know are a bad idea. Burning coal is a bad idea. Burning our forests is a bad idea. And a call for moratorium on deforestation is clearly worth exploring, and a close look at the land tenure arrangements within those areas is going to be crucial. If you have ownership or agency over the land that you actually live on, and with the right arrangements, that is probably going to be the securest way of hanging on to our forests, the planet's forests. And as to whether we can aggressively expand these, I suppose I would say that the climate challenge is looking so serious that we definitely need to research this. We need to be researching it urgently. But I suppose I'd add a note of caution that historically our interventions in large-scale ecosystems have often been sort of fraught with reverse consequences. And so we need to be particularly careful when we go into this, especially given the scale that is implied. If we're addressing the billions of tons of carbon that need to be drawn out of the atmosphere, then forest practices that would reforest areas would be talking on very, very large scales, and there are serious implications there for local peoples and just for the carbon and for the reflectivity of the planet that we need to be really, really careful on before we throw ourselves into them.
Coming back to the current discussions, do you think that the aim of limiting the rise in temperatures to 2 degrees centigrade, is that a safe aim, or does that itself represent a tipping point?
I think that is another thing where our understanding has changed over the last several years. And unfortunately, there was too much of an impression that prior interglacial periods were a few degrees warmer. It turns out, at the top of the ice sheets where measurements were made, indirect measurements of the temperature at which the snow formed, the temperature was 2 or 3 degrees warmer during the warmest interglacials than it is during the current interglacial. But on the global average, now that we have ocean cores from around most of the global oceans, which also give us a way of inferring what the ocean temperature was, that the warmest interglacials were not more than about 1 degree warmer than the pre-industrial level. So a more appropriate target would have been 1 degree. The 2 degrees is very likely to mean that we would not have any sea ice in the Arctic, that we would not have any mountain glaciers. So unfortunately, that target, even though it's considered difficult, is too high. And it's, this very bad news to be giving to governments. But, you can't change the laws of physics. And what is becoming clear is that we're pushing the system beyond a level that would allow us to maintain a planet that looks like the planet that has existed for the last 10 to 12,000 years. The Earth's climate has gone through very large oscillations in the past, and you might say, maybe a different climate would be all right, but unfortunately we've set up our civilization and our infrastructure with sea level where it is and with climate zones where they are. And the implications of moving out of this climate, of the recent climate range, would be enormous in terms of, it's happened before, and when it has happened, it's driven more than half the species on the planet to extinction. And over hundreds of thousands of years, you got new species. But that's a time scale which we cannot imagine. It would be generations, any generation that we can think of, it would be a much more desolate planet.
If I can try and answer your question as simply as I can. Again, I think with the changes that we're seeing today and the impacts that we're seeing today, just with our 0.8 degree rise in temperature above pre-industrial temperatures, we can say that even this is definitely too high. And I think in exploring 2 degrees or any other temperature, it's worth looking at the tool that is used by the IPCC and by climate scientists to make a conversion from the concentration of carbon in our atmosphere to the temperature. Now, this is obviously a very complex set of arrangements and causal chain in there, but it all gets summed up in a term called climate sensitivity, which refers to the sensitivity of our planet's temperatures to atmospheric concentrations. And this sensitivity, it's a technical term, but it's at its heart, it's not that complicated. I'd like to say it's simple. At its heart, really, it looks at what would happen if you instantaneously do a hypothetical, so if you instantaneously double atmospheric concentrations from one level to another, so say from 280 to 560 parts per million, and you look at the consequent temperature rise. So by doing that, you get a sense of all of your climate modelling and your understanding of paleoclimate and your observations today. If you can double atmospheric concentrations and see the temperature rise, that gives you a measure of how sensitive our climate is. And if you understand that sensitivity, that climate sensitivity, then you can apply it to any particular concentration level. And so the IPCC, in exploring 450 parts per million CO2e, CO2 equivalent, as a stabilization level, also uses this mechanism. It has a range. The IPCC has drawn on a range of sensitivities, and it says that it's most likely to be somewhere between 2 and 4.5 degrees of sensitivity. So if we doubled atmospheric concentrations, we'd get somewhere between 2 and 4.5 degrees temperature rise. Now, we're obviously not going to double atmospheric concentrations, or I certainly hope we don't. If we talk about a particular level of concentration, we can apply this metric to it. So looking at 450 parts per million, applying their middle of the range sensitivity of 3, and seeing what that implies for global temperature rise, it translates to a 2-degree temperature rise. However, in their own notes, they recognise and encourage policymakers, or in as stronger language as they can, which is they say that policymakers may like to include the 4.5 measure of climate sensitivity in their likely range of explorations. So they are saying we should consider 4.5 as the sensitivity of our climate. And if we do use 4.5 rather than 3, which is the middle figure, if we do use 4.5 when translating our carbon concentrations to a temperature rise, what we see is that 450 ppmv does not give us 2 degrees of temperature rise, it gives us 3.1. And in fact, we have very good reason to think that it might be this higher figure, it might be 4.5, for all the reasons we've just been discussing about the triple melt in the Arctic, the information coming in since the IPCC's fourth assessment report, and all the indications are that our climate is more sensitive than we previously thought. What this is leading us to understand is that our climate is warming faster than we had anticipated. And what this means is that we need to be taking action more urgently than we previously thought.
Given the current policy trends, 450 is not going to be reached. What kind of temperature increase are you projecting using that kind of wider range of possibilities?
I don't know if it's in the briefing note. Do you have this picture, bar graph like that?
Somewhere, but can you remind me what your position is?
Essentially, it's to say that whatever stabilization level we choose, there's obviously temperatures associated with it, and the sensitivity that we explore is key there. And I think, as Dr. Hansen is saying, we can't allow the fact that we're finding it difficult to meet a 450 stabilization. We can't use that as a reason for ignoring it and going for something lower. We do need to go for something lower. And what we find is that regardless of our future stabilization level, whether it is 450 or whether it's even 550 or a much lower level of 350 or lower, the actions today in terms of our emissions cuts are really the same. Does that answer your question?
Well, not really. I was wanting you to give some indication of the kind of temperature increases that you regard as most likely on current trends at whatever point in the period.
Dr. Hansen might be able to talk about a 6-degree sensitivity, and if we apply a 6-degree sensitivity to a 450 parts per million stabilisation, we'd end up with 4.1 degrees of temperature rises, somewhere thereabouts.
Let's be specific about the question again. Could you repeat that?
Well, the question was that on the most likely, on your analysis of the current trends based upon current policies and current situation, what would you
regard as the most likely figure for future temperature rise, taking into account the comments about climate sensitivity, which we should be working on as likely to occur if policies don't change.
If policies give us 450 ppm, is that...
If policies give us more than 450, which at present trend seems to be likely, what kind of temperature increase are we talking about at whatever point in the future you think is relevant to tell us about?
Well, it depends upon what time in the future you're talking about. Obviously. If we want to talk about, say, 2100, well, the temperature had the last 30 years has been increasing 0.2 degrees Celsius per decade. Business as usual would have that probably accelerate to 0.3 degrees per decade. And so over the next 92 years, I would expect something between 2 and 3 degrees with that type of scenario. So it obviously puts us far into the dangerous range, and I can't imagine that humanity will be that foolish, but that I think that's where we would end up. And we would obviously end up, we would be headed toward an ice-free planet, and we would have our ice sheets would be beginning to disintegrate, and we would have a situation that we would leave our children and grandchildren a situation out of their control.
I think I should just point out to the committee, having just taken over in the chair, that as you were saying in your evidence to us, there's a very little amount of time in which to actually deal with the whole climate change issue, and so with our select committee this afternoon. So I'm just going to ask all my colleagues if we can just to try and just speed up a little bit, Mr. Chaser.
I'd like to ask Dr. Hansen about carbon capture and storage, because you're unequivocal about the need to stop opening new coal-fired power stations without CCS.
Right.
But you seem to assume that fitting CCS is a routine matter that will solve the problem of coal emissions, and that can be done quickly. So could you say something about
when do you think CCS
will be workable?
I think that we should have urgent research and development to have commercially available both carbon capture and sequestration and next generation nuclear power. But frankly, I do not think that carbon capture and sequestration is likely to play a big role in the future. I think that it will just make coal more expensive and it will become less competitive. But yet, I'd like very much to see that R&D, because that carbon capture and sequestration can be used in combination with biofuels. If you have a power plant that is burning biofuels, then while the plants are growing that you make the biofuels from, they draw the CO2 out of the atmosphere. You burn the biofuels in a power plant, capture the CO2, and sequester it. And that way you can draw down the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere and help us get back below 350. And we're going to realize over the next decade or so, we're going to realize we have to do things like that. And that's a sort of natural geoengineering.
Yeah. And what's your best estimate of the earliest date on which CCS could be widely available?
It could be widely implemented. You could have the technology ready and available as an option for utilities within less than a decade. And I frankly think that the West, Europe and the United States, should be cooperating with China and India to move both that technology and next-generation nuclear power rapidly, because there is, especially in China and India, where they've got to have some technologies available that do not put CO2 in the atmosphere.
Secondly, could I ask about the various forms of geoengineering that are currently being discussed? We read about a range of ideas that seem completely off the planet, and some of them are off the planet because they're involving putting mirrors in the atmosphere. But you've been interested in biochar particularly. Could you just tell us why you feel so strongly that this may be the most successful form of geoengineering?
Well, I think those geoengineering suggestions, which are basically natural, that are the things that would make sense. And those things which you know, we do need to we'll need to reduce the amount of CO2 because it's not just the climate effect, but the things like acidification of the ocean. So the CO2 has got to be a target, and biochar and biofuels with the carbon CO2 captured and sequestered would both draw down the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. Biochar refers to the working into the soil charcoal, which increases the productivity of the soil, and it's a technique which has been used in ancient cultures in the Middle East and in South America, and it's worth exploring that and understanding to what degree that would be applicable in the rest of the world, because in many cases we have our agricultural practices have actually not been very good, so the soils are releasing CO2, and we could actually get the soils to store more CO2. In fact, the soils contain twice as much carbon as the atmosphere. And by improved agricultural practices, not only trying to work charcoal into the soil, but just less invasive, more low-till or no-till agriculture as opposed to plowing up the soil such that it releases CO2.
You, Mr. Helwig, the Zero Carbon Britain Report, which I was very pleased to receive a copy of when I visited McKinley earlier this year, it sets out all your proposals for Zero Carbon Britain, but it hasn't really caught on, has it, in terms of the general public? And I just wonder how much you think that the recommendations in this report have been taken up by the general public, and how much as well you feel that they are compatible with the, and I put in inverted commas, the need for economic growth.
Right. Well, thanks for asking the question. Doing the work for the Zero Carbon Britain report was very instructive in exploring all of the means that we have for cutting our energy consumption. And it was also useful in exploring all of the myriad ways we have for generating renewable power here in Britain. And Britain is, in fact, uniquely placed in Europe to power both ourselves and others. We sit at the brunt end of the Atlantic winds, and consequently we have the largest wind resource and the largest marine energy resource of any nation in Europe. I'll come on to that in just a second, but your specific question was about how it's caught on with the public in the UK. I think that the public is going to be choosing, they're going to be choosing low-cost energy. And at the moment, our situation with the energy companies and the way it's structured at the moment does not favour that. There is no incentive for the energy companies today to encourage their customers to use less of the energy company's product. The energy companies are playing into a saturated market. There is no opportunity for growth because we have 60 million people in the UK and not much more. We're not growing our industry in any big way. And so they have two ways to maintain their profits. One is to maintain the size of the market, i.e. not encouraging their customers to use less of their product, and secondly, to keep the prices high. And prices in the energy market today are determined by the price of fossil fuel. They mark them up as to sell them from fossil fuels into electricity power for us. And there is no incentive for us to move out of that. That is a business model of yesteryear, and we need to be looking now at a business model that makes best use of energy efficiency and clean energy technologies. And what we'll find is that it's a much more dynamic business, that if we look actually from the perspective of UK PLC, or even, I'd suggest, a UK wind PLC, we'll see that our access to energy, our access to renewable energy, and the scale to which we develop our wind resources does not need to be constrained by the amount of energy that we would feed into our own national grid. It does not need to be constrained by the balancing of supply and demand here in Britain. The Carbon Trust have shown that if we provided 30% of the UK's electricity from renewable technologies, it would actually cost us less overall. The International Energy Agency has shown that if we move to an almost complete renewable technology scenario over the next 50 years, it would cost us less money overall. And the crucial thing here is that is a national perspective and an international perspective and not an isolated business perspective. What we need to see happen now is for the government to call for a business plan to be written for a UK wind PLC, to be drawn up by the Treasury, and to be to draw on the expertise of the Carbon Trust, of DEC, of BER, and the other other relevant departments. And we need to not be constrained by what we can just sell to our domestic market. We know that if we lay links to Europe, there is a market of 500 million people out there looking for energy, hungry for energy that is secure, as fossil fuels are not, that is clean, as fossil fuels are not, and ultimately will become cheaper than fossil fuels are today.
And given that since that report we've got the economic crisis, and as we speak indeed the debate is taking place in the floor of the House of Commons, would you say that there are opportunities arising out of the changed circumstances
Absolutely.
That we're in now on the pre-budget report to link that kind of innovative linkage with environmental limits to growth and the Treasury and the need for more jobs? And how could, for example, the Centre for Alternative Technology be involved in that process?
The key element that can trigger this this transition to a fossil fuel-free future and to a zero-carbon Britain would be the introduction of government energy bonds. It's a simple idea. It's one that we almost have already. We have government bonds. Government bonds have been issued in wartime and in peacetime when we've needed to build massive amounts of infrastructure. And what it would mean is that if the government is... The government can facilitate huge coordinated infrastructure transition. It can provide the mechanism for individuals and for business and the Treasury, even if it likes, to pay in to a mechanism which will fund this. People need to have the opportunity to share in the profits of our wind and our marine resource. And at the moment, it's an untapped potential. As you say, it does play perfectly into the current economic situation, and it also provides the Treasury with an extra lever on inflation, and it's obviously going to produce huge numbers of jobs. And if we look at the cost of making the transition to a fossil fuel free nation, we see that yes, it's going to be costly. Actually, it's going to be enormously costly. But what is the single largest cost component? It's going to be highly paid, highly skilled jobs, and those are going to be in the UK. And for UK Wind PLC, that will be an internal transaction. That will not affect our balance of payments, and that will only bolster our economy.
That's very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Caton.
You've told us about latest scientific findings and very disturbing the idea. But what are the biggest continuing gaps in scientific knowledge and understanding of climate change that we face, and how can we fill them?
Well, the human influence on climate is not limited to CO2 and other greenhouse gases. We've known for a long time that there's another influence of humans that is a comparable order of magnitude and is not very well quantified, and that's the effect of small particles that we emit into the atmosphere, sulfates and soot. Overall, these have tended to cause a cooling effect, and that's why one of the reasons why the Earth's temperature didn't do much until we reached a point where the greenhouse gases were clearly dominant over the aerosol effect. But still, it's an aspect which we need to quantify. And finally, next year, we should begin to get satellite measurements, which will allow us to quantify that aspect. And that will be helpful. But the other thing where improved knowledge is necessary is the internal ocean temperature, because that's our best way of that's our way of determining what the planet's energy balance is. We expect that as we add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, that there will be more energy coming into the planet than going out, because the effect of the greenhouse gases is to reduce emission to space. Well, where does that energy imbalance show up? The ability of the atmosphere to hold energy is very limited. The heat capacity of the atmosphere is very small, but the ocean is where the heat imbalance has to show up. And so we need to have good measurements of ocean temperature throughout the ocean, not just the upper 700 meters. And so scientifically, I think those are the two two things where we need improved knowledge. But all that does is make more precise our knowledge of how the climate is changing and how what we can expect in the next few decades. But we already know enough to know that the planet is out of energy balance, and we have a pretty good idea of what the limits on atmospheric composition should be. And unfortunately, it's bad news that we've been giving you. But as I say, we can't, the laws of physics aren't really negotiable.
Yeah, I think this is the key point, that the climate science has done one job very effectively, and that job is done to tell us that we now need to take action. We don't need any more science to tell us that we have an urgent problem on our hands and we need to be doing everything we can to get out of it. What the climate science is now, its role now, is in helping us to understand the sort of decadal changes in climate and the regional changes in climate, so that we can adapt, because we will need to, and build our resilience to the changes that we might expect. Yes, there are going to be need for improved research, and that must be as well funded as possible, and it must be put to the absolute top of the agenda. We can be increasing the resolution of our climate models. We can be increasing the number and the detail with which we understand the mechanisms within that. We need to be integrating our climate models with our paleoclimate understanding, with the measurements today on the ground. We need to be doing all of this and more, and we need to be accelerating in any which way we can the process of peer review and the scientific cycle of feedback within itself to accelerate our trajectory of understanding. But what we know today is that our climate is changing faster than expected, and we know that the consequences are unmanageable if we let them go too far. So that we know that today that we need to be taking full action to decarbonize our economy, because that is the one lever that we most clearly hold, and that requires us to step off the upward trajectory of carbon emissions onto the downward trajectory. And so I would really encourage a short-term goal that fits with our long-term ambitions, that we make a 10% reduction in the next couple of years, both to demonstrate that we mean what we talk about, but also because we won't be able to meet any long-term objectives unless we have stepped onto that path.
That really leads me on to my next question, because, as you say, that there is enough science, and has been for a while now, to know that we've got to do something.
Yes.
Why do you think it is that policymakers across the globe are failing to show the sort of urgency that you've called for today?
I think this is a challenge for all of us. We certainly don't have all of the answers, but I think in part because we haven't understood the full nature of the problem, in part because the problem is not one we're used to. We are used to being able to juggle our problems and sort of put some of them to the back of the queue. But really, with this, it's drawing up targets for the future is too quick to become just writing another to-do list. And if we do need to prioritise the actions that we have to take and the things we have to do, we need to be prioritising them not just for importance, we need to be prioritising them for urgency. And the urgent, important thing to do now is to make carbon cuts today.
Well, I think if I could add to that, I think that the politics of the system seems to favour short-term over the long-term. And short-term, it's difficult to make the changes which make sense on the long-term. And the people who are affected on the long term, the young and the unborn and the nature, don't have much voice in our decisions. That's what, you know, we have to change. And I think young people are beginning to recognize the situation, and we're going to see more and more actions to try to force the political systems to respond for the good of young people and future generations. But so far, the fossil fuel industry has had more influence on our policies than young people have.
I'm
just being brought to my attention that you need to be out of this room by 3:30 promptly. And I'm just thinking, in order to enable the committee to get through the further questions in this first session that we have, whether or not you would just perhaps like to add any remaining bits which you felt hasn't been said. And then, if that's okay with my colleagues, we can then continue the end of this first session with Mr. Helvig Larsson. If you just extend anything else, because I know you have to be out at 3:30.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think I've said the main points I wanted to make, but I'd just like to underline the fact that because of the long lifetime of CO2, and because CO2 is the dominant issue, we do have to look at where it's coming from, and the conclusion that you have to draw is we've got to do something about coal, and we have to also avoid unconventional fossil fuels like tar shale and tar sands, but that goes almost without being said. Maybe if I could say one more thing, I think that we are going to have to put a price on carbon emissions. And I know that it's a very politically very difficult thing to do. Green taxes are resisted even after when they get not even very large. But I think, and it may not be a topic for this committee, but I think we have to have a tax and 100% dividend in which the government taxes carbon emissions, but it gives all the money back to the public on a per capita basis. So you get everyone gets the same share back, but you pay according to what you put into the atmosphere. And if that's recognized that that tax is going to grow with time, then we would transform society in ways that would allow us to transition to a no-carbon future. And if we don't have that economic incentive, I think it's going to be very hard to do it.
Well, that's said. Many thanks indeed for sparing the time to exceptionally come before our committee this afternoon. We're very grateful.
Thank you. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Thank you. We'll proceed, Mr. Chater.
I'm sorry, Dr. Hansen has had to leave because my question was really to him, because he said that the laws of physics are not negotiable. But if that's the case, why are the IPCC reports so conservative in their assumptions? And why is the arguments and the evidence that you both have been putting forward now not fully incorporated into the last IPCC report?
Okay. I can perhaps answer this in part. I think the nature of the challenge for the science community has changed over time. This perhaps started off like many other scientific endeavours to understand a particular area, in this case to understand our climate science, and much like trying to understand forestry or the human system, It's a scientific endeavour and it takes time. And scientists, their very reputation, their very careers are based around the validity of the work that they publish. And there is a huge built-in conservatism in that process. And that doesn't go away when we pull together the work of the scientific community around the world on climate change to produce the IPCC reports. In fact, in many ways, it adds an extra layer of conservatism because you're working not to build a consensus between all of these groups, because that's not what the IPCC is setting out to do, but a synthesis. And so I think that's part of where it's come from. The IPCC has had that challenge, as has the whole scientific community. I think another element would be that the climate scientists have been, for a long time, just trying to be heard and understood. They've stumbled across a very big issue which affects all of us, and people haven't been listening to them for some time. And those that were listening were being dissuaded by the fossil fuel industry and interests that were against that scientific pursuit. And so, one of the things that they've tried to do is to put across the very most serious consequences of climate change, to try and break through that sort of stupor that the public and all of us seem to have been in, in not recognising the issue. But in doing that, they are making the science as conservative as possible so that they can be absolutely sure about it. And I think really the challenge is building the interface between that body of work, that body of understanding about climate change and the contributing authors to it, such as Dr. Hansen, building an interface between that and policymakers. And I don't think that interface is there in as robust a way as we need it to be. I think policymakers really need to be familiar with some of these mechanisms such as climate sensitivity. They need to be absolutely au fait with the distinction between flows of carbon emission and the stock, and some of these, and they need to be familiar with how we manage uncertainty and risk. And I think it's a lot for them to get to grips with, and I think it's only going to become clearer as time goes by.
Going back to continuing what you're talking about influencing policymakers, one thing that you would have galvanised policymakers is exactly what you've been talking about today, which is where we're seeing observed change.
Yeah.
It's not just projections, it's observed change in the Arctic, in the mountain glaciers. Do you think that is going to change policymakers?
I don't think it will change it on its own. I think we've had information for some time. Yes, it's been caveated and bubble wrapped, perhaps, but I think it's incumbent on every aspect of our society to make a noise about this. We have, if you like, a cycle of reasonableness at the moment, where we've got the media putting a climate change article on the same on a facing page to an advert for a car. We've got business structured and regulated in such a way that you can make fantastic profits out of destroying the atmosphere. And we've got government which is constrained by both of these and by the public whose understanding is formed by business and the media. And so all of these feed into each other, and we could bemoan all this, but we have to look at the opportunities that exist to break out of that pattern. We have to look at how can the media break free of its constraints, and how can the public seek to find information that is really going to give them the latest information, the latest understanding, so that they can vote with understanding on climate change.
In your view, is the IPCC process fit for purpose, and is it going to be able to respond to greater demand for more focused and timely reports?
Is it fit for purpose? I'm going to say two things. The first is that this is, without a doubt, the IPCC process is, without a doubt, the most impressive scientific endeavour that we've seen to date. That is a different question from is it fit for purpose? And if it continues the way it is structured today, no, I don't think it's fit for the purpose of informing policymakers and to take the action that's needed to secure a climate that is safe. I think many of the elements and components within the IPCC process are going to be essential in informing policymakers and are going to be essential in guiding us to that place of climate safety. And those will include the stringent peer review process. They will include the networks and distribution channels that the IPCC has. What we need to see is really the speeding up and the acceleration of the IPCC process so that it can outpace the acceleration of climate change. And that's going to involve all sorts of creative thinking and ways of perhaps bringing some of the journals into a more online, more live and real-time collaborative process than we see today. We need to make use of the valuable assets we have, and we need to restructure them so that they can work fast enough.
Thank you very much.
Okay, on that note, can I thank you very much indeed for coming before
Great,
the committee for this special hearing, and congratulations and good luck on your journey to climate safety. Thank you very much.
Thank you.